Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, and a very warm welcome back indeed to Caroline, who was not on the last podcast. So welcome back.
I'm struggling to remember. Like, where have I been? Like, why are you welcoming me back?
I think you were on holiday.
Yes, I was on holiday. Yes. Gosh, been a while then, because memories of my holiday are long forgotten now.
It's not been that long. But we did miss you. Our colleague Ryan Priest was on that episode. It was great to have him back. That was good fun. And of course, Claire filled in on one of Caroline's sustainability stories.
Yeah, that's why I missed you, because I had to actually read something in preparation for the podcast.
Today we're recording on Friday the 26th of November. December is nearly here, which means Christmas is thundering towards us. We've seen some early harbingers of Christmas, Christmas lights and stuff.
I went for a walk the other day there was a house not too far from mine where they were doing it. They were having like a street party to announce the fact that their Christmas lights at this house were being switched on. And I tweeted about it. I've only seen it during the daytime. So I'm going to go back at some point after dark and see it in all its glory. But I was just like, oh my God, this is like amazing production values. They've not just there's lights everywhere. There's a nativity scene. There's snowmen, there's Santa, you know, all the main stars of the Christmas story, depending on whatever, you know, if you're religious or not, are all in attendance. Yeah, so I've got to go back after dark and see that. But I was so impressed. And like I say, the fact they were like, be here, 6:30, big switch on tonight. I was like, wow. Just like, oh God, do I take a really long walk and then circle back at that time? But yeah, I couldn't justify it. But yeah, that was very exciting. That was like, that's a week ago. So more than a month before Christmas. That's how excited people are.
Yeah, the Christmas market in Oxford last weekend. It was quite nice to see. But Claire, we've done some Christmas crafting.
Yeah, we have. That was lots of fun. Every quarter we raise money for a particular charity. And this quarter's charity was Save the Children. So people who wanted to participate in the Christmas crafting donated some cash to Save the Children. And then one of our colleagues taught us how to make origami gift boxes, and we also hand sewed some cards as well, although Brian ducked out at that point.
Yeah, I'd reached the limit of my competence. My box making was probably not the best in class.
I think I chose the wrong paper for you for a beginning box. I think it was a little bit too rigid and you were finding it difficult to make accurate folds. I think if you'd have started off with paper, you would have been okay. I take the blame.
I did turn up 10 minutes late, I suppose, for the crafting session. And had it not been for Claire and indeed the other Claire, because we have two Claires on the Computer Weekly team, I don't think I would have made a box at all. But I'm determined to go back and have a look on YouTube as to how to make a box and, you know, take it from there. But it was quite good fun.
So when you say you wouldn't have made a box, would you prefer to freestyle and make something completely different? Like go against
no,
the rest of the group? Oh, no, I thought you'd go like, just go
no,
just, total
no, I'm
rebel.
Just talking about absolute basics, yeah. Basics. It was quite a strange experience because I felt like I'd wandered into the wrong cave. I was the only bloke who went to the Christmas crafting.
I don't get why. It's just a bit of fun, isn't it? But everybody else missed out.
Certainly glad I went.
Yeah, it was good. It you know, it lets you interact with your colleagues a little bit.
Yeah.
And doing something a bit different. And people had baked for the occasion. So there were cookies and cakes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It was nice.
I enjoyed it. Christmas wise, I'm heading up to the SAP user conference in Birmingham this weekend. And that's always got a bit of a Christmassy feel to it, that conference. Especially their party on the kind of first night where all the SAP managers let their hair down.
oh my God, what a vision. Sorry, I'm just like, oh, wow, wild times.
It's wild. And it's not a bad gender split because you've got like HR managers and, you know, BI people as well as your kind of ERP implementers. From the user group. It was quite good fun. It's very down to earth. event. And there's usually also a pretty good Christmas market in Birmingham itself. Although we shall see. I think people are finding it difficult to get over from Germany. You know, the pandemic is still with us and things are pretty grim in some places in Germany. But anyway, I mean, many of our listeners will be thinking about this whole business of Christmas parties, to have them, not to have them. I think we've got a couple of our own Christmas parties coming up, haven't we?
We got stuff going on.
Okay, well, let's get on with the show today, just to say, as usual, where we're going. So Caroline, for you, it's COP26 revisited.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I spent a day, I think, in Scotland. Well, just over 24 hours, which, again, I think is why I'm struggling to remember, like, where was I the last time we had a podcast? Was I in Scotland? Was I on holiday? Who knows? But yes, I went there, and as a guest of the Open Source Pressure Group, Open UK, to their technology day. I can't remember which way around it was. Technology for Sustainability Day, or Sustainability for Technology? Who knows? It's all tech, sustainability, all good stuff. So.
Well, we'll come to that very soon. And Claire, it's the skills that the nation needs. It's your focus today.
Skills and diversity. All of my focus, all of the time. I'm excited. Yeah.
And me, towards the end of the podcast, I'm going to touch on what we like to call the post office story. Specifically a new book, The Great Post Office Scandal, which was launched on the Monday just passed. But we're starting with Caroline and her visit to my homeland. Did you enjoy it?
I think it's the dictionary definition of a whistle-stop tour. I guess I saw the greatest hits of Scotland. I mean, I was, like I said, I was there just over 24 hours. I arrived by train into Edinburgh and took a coach to the Scottish market town of Crieff for the night, which is where the hotel was we put up for the evening.
Crieff is supposed to be lovely.
Well, I arrived in the dark by coach, so I was just like, oh, lots of twisty, windy roads, feels very hilly. And then in the morning, when we got the coach back to Glasgow, again, like I say, so all the greatest hits, Edinburgh, Glasgow, done it. It's just like, oh my God, the scenery like around here is amazing. Like, you just didn't see it, obviously, on the journey there because it's dark. So lots of rolling hills, lots of sheep. Yeah, big fan. Very nice. This is probably unnecessary detail. But on the way from Edinburgh to Crieff, one of the people we were travelling with on the coach actually knows the area really well. So he treated us to a little coach tour as well, giving us the highlights and tourist spots of Edinburgh as we drove around.
That's cute.
Yeah, gave another little dimension to things. But yeah, I should probably discuss why I was there. It wasn't just sightseeing and cheap and touristy stuff. As I mentioned, I was in Glasgow for Open UK's COP26 fringe event. For the uninitiated, Open UK has sort of billed as a sort of open source pressure group. One of the main discussion points at their event was the role that open source technologies and the communities surrounding open source technologies should play in the fight against climate change. So, like, for example, in an open source community, you'll usually have a technology that the contributors to that, like, community all work on, develop in the hopes, well, one hopes that they can improve upon it and advance it and add new functionality to it. Kind of theme of the event was that through collaboration and the use of open technologies, there's a hope that with everyone working together, enable society to come up with the level of innovation needed to help address the climate crisis. So you mentioned earlier that Claire tackled a story of mine when I wasn't here about Microsoft and the thoughts of their chief sustainability officer on the climate crisis. And in that story, I'm not sure if Claire talked about it or not, but Microsoft's chief sustainability officer basically said, you know, in terms of solving the climate crisis, it's going to require sort of moon landing levels of technology innovation. And that's not something like any company or individual can do on their own. So that's kind of a similar sort of theme playing out at this Open UK event. You know, we all need to work together, we need to use open technologies to get where we need to go in terms of addressing climate change. So there were some really, really interesting discussions at the event about all that. But the thing that really captured my imagination and got me thinking with some ideas that Open UK presented around how to make the data centers of the future sort of net zero entities and just more sustainable overall. For Open UK, they've created this blueprint. It's called, because it's Scotland, Patchwork Kilt. And it basically, this consists of sort of six interconnected areas or buckets, they call it, that sort of data center operators sort of need to address to make their sort of server farms and facilities sort of leaner and greener. And, you know, these areas sort of cover sort of how data centers are built, how they're powered, regulated, you know, how they're kitted out with hardware, you know, area things that all need addressing to make them kind of more sustainable overall. And there's loads of little different points to that, and you can read more detail on all of that on Computer Weekly. I did a sort of write-up about Patchwork Kill and Open UK's plans to expand the areas that it covers. But there was one area specifically in all of that that really, really just got me thinking. As I was sat there, they're sort of talking about kind of this, you know, here's an idea put forward in Patchwork Kill, this is what we're going to do. And I don't know, it's something Claire might have some thoughts on as well, but I don't want to put her under any pressure in case she's listening to it. Like, I don't care. I literally don't care. But I don't know. This idea they put forward is that, you know, one way to minimize the environmental impacts of data centers is by placing smaller sort of edge-like processing hubs in disused shops and office spaces. So that their argument being that, you know, the high streets have been in decline since before the start of the pandemic, and that's worsened in many cases as a result of lockdowns and people becoming more comfortable with doing sort of shopping online. So therefore we've got all these empty retail spaces, so why not build sort of mini data centers in them? And there is kind of like an emerging use case for this. We're hearing, you know, we've been hearing for years now about how edge data centers are going to be the next big thing, you know, because, you know, you need to have kind of compute power processing much closer to where the users are, so to get faster response times and things like that. So there is demand for sort of smaller local edge data centers slightly closer to where the users are. So that's what they're kind of suggesting, like, why not, you know, where people are moving to hybrid working models, there's a lot of empty office space going begging, there's, like I say, retail sites, so why not do that? And one of the, again, a reason for this is not just because, oh, well, that'd be nice to use some shops up and things like that, or like use some shop space up. But when we talk about sustainability in data centers, we often talk about energy efficiency, how much electricity they consume and things like that. But one thing that we kind of report less on, but is becoming increasingly important, is the fact that data centers actually consume quite a lot of energy, and there's lots of carbon carbon emissions generated just by the actual physical act of building them. So it's kind of like, so instead of having to build one from scratch, and we can reuse sites that are already there, you know, that's right. Kind of a sustainability play as well. I like that idea. I'm not sure how easy in practice it'll be. I don't know if you could apply for a change of use from being a retail site to a data center. I don't know how easy that is.
Thoughts just off of the top of my head on this. Obviously, in a lot of cases where there are empty lots on a high street that need to be filled with something, there's obviously this trend towards changing physical retail sites into something more of like an experience. And that tends to work better for larger retail sites than it does for smaller retail sites, which means that I guess it would work if you change some of the smaller shops that have gone out of business, and then you're going to use those, you know, repurpose them into a data center or something like that. But I think it's probably less likely to be a thing in smaller local high streets. Does that make sense? Because in sort of like a smaller local high street, you might have more independent businesses that need to rent out a smaller space. And if you take up, like, especially after the pandemic, now that things are starting to get back to normal, that's probably an opportunity that can arise again. Mm-hmm. Whereas in larger high streets, like maybe in central London or somewhere like that, where the smaller bits of real estate don't really fit in with this new retail as an experience type trend that seems to be going forward. That's just my first thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, yeah, as they were talking about it, I was kind of like, that's great. Like you say, local high streets, for example, yeah, move the processing power near to where the users are. But, you know, so what kind of workloads is that going to be? Like in a village high street, like, oh, well, we've got a data center there. Like, so what are the users needing that for?
Especially where the internet, like broadband, isn't always necessarily a brilliant thing in a rural area. I know that it says that, you know, like they would be 5G connected data centers, but then it still has to go from the data center to the nearby people that are using it, and that connection isn't likely to be as good.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. The kind of thing I was thinking of is like you say, you have got the bigger retail sites in sort of shopping centres, and in a shopping centre, they would be well serviced by power, and a lot of them are internet connected for lots of different reasons now. And the thing I was thinking of, it could work quite well when you've got, say, department stores that have got, the owners of those sites obviously have multiple floors usually. So that's quite a big undertaking for any retailer to move into. Seems that you can't, like, department stores, those stores were built specifically for those retailers, and now the demand for those retailers doesn't exist. So could it be a case of whoever owns those sites could portion them off? So you've got part of it is still retail space, part of it is can be used for a data center, that kind of thing. That was, I don't, like I say, I was sat there like, oh, I could see how this could work. Like, there is lots of talk about how you can build sort of edge data centers nearer to people. And there's things like, oh, well, you could repurpose sort of existing street furniture, like lampposts, put like little data processing hubs in lampposts, because again, they've got power. Or I think there is a push at the moment around some of the telephone exchange boxes that are along pavement. Some of them aren't needed anymore, that the equipment's been upgraded to such an extent there's not so many needed anymore. So could you put little data centers in those and stuff like that? So it's quite an interesting idea.
Does it ever bother you that, like, you don't know what's going on? Like, so you could, you know, when I don't know
how, like, all the time. You've had me talk on this podcast. I don't know what I'm talking about most of the time.
What I meant by that, though.
Oh, okay.
Not in day-to-day life. But, you know, you'd see a lamppost and then you'd be like, but there's a data center in there and you don't know. Or the telephone exchange boxes and you think, oh, yeah, I think I know what this does. But it's like, no, it's a supercomputer.
Actually, that reminds me, this is kind of behind the scenes life at TechTarget Computer Weekly stuff, but I had to give a presentation ages ago to some of our sales and marketing people about, like, what are data centers? What's the trend in data centers? And this is a couple of years ago. And we were talking about edge data centers then. And I was like, yeah, you know, street furniture, you could put data centers in these boxes, which just goes to show not a lot happens in the world of data centers. In fact, I was speaking about this about 2-3 years ago, like breaking news. Anyway, but one of the things someone came up with was like, okay, like someone asked this question. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually a bit stumped by that. Like, what happens if there was a car accident and it wiped out your edge data center? And then how do you bring it back online again? And I was like, that's a really good point, because these big centralized data centers are like bomb proof, they're terrorist proof, they're, you can't break into them. Yeah. But then it's someone comes along in like a Robin Reliant, tips it over and crashes into your lamppost, you're done for, you know. So yeah, it does remind me of that a little bit, like, yep, doesn't seem very safe. But then if it's only a small amount of compute power, maybe you could push it onto another site nearby. But yeah, it does make you wonder, like, you know, you're not just, like I say, hitting a lamppost, you could be taking out like a whole local network of IT, you know. Terrible. There's another bit to this story that, like I say, it all kind of got me thinking. I was sat there, there's something at the moment about, in terms of making data centers more sustainable, one of the things is like about how you can make better use of like the byproducts of data centers. So obviously data centers have lots of servers in them, lots of equipment that generates a lot of hot air. So when they're trying to keep them cool, they have to remove the hot air from the data halls and stuff like that. And it's like, well, what do you do with that hot air? So it's kind of like, well, if you put little data centers in some of these city centers, you know, is there opportunities there to reuse that heat sort of, you know, buildings, housing, that kind of thing, which actually feeds into the government's sort of net zero strategy, where they flagged that reusing waste heat from data centers could play quite an important role in helping to decarbonize the economy. So by having sort of smaller data centers in the middle of town centers, the heat from those could be used to warm, like I say, surrounding homes and businesses. But I think we could be a bit more ambitious than that, because I don't know, if we look to Norway, which is something I quite enjoy doing, there's a data center company there called Green Mountain, and they've agreed to let a lobster farm be built next to one of its data centers. So the waste heat from that data center can be used to help keep the lobsters warm, help them grow big and fat, and then they can be sold on and served up in lovely fish restaurants and stuff.
Didn't the laws around lobsters in the UK just change? Like, they're sentient beings now, so you can't kill them in the same way or something.
You know what? I'm going to have to hold my hands up here and say I am not completely up to 100% date on what's going on with lobsters. I do try to, I do, but you know, sometimes things slide, and it's the lobsters in this case. But that could be, that could be true. In which case, that same company also has a similar heat reuse arrangement with a trout farm as well. So,
it might not be, it might not be true, but I do, I follow a lot of vegan hashtags on Instagram, and I feel like lobsters have been a thing recently.
Could be, it could be. I mean, there's things like I guess like nurseries, like not kids ones, but like the flower nurseries.
Plants.
Yeah, could be things like that. So I think, yeah, you could make, oh, literally make the high streets sort of greener by having like co-locating data centers with them, little mini garden centers. There you go. That's the use case.
There you go. Like the, oh, like those you know, the farms, the vertical farming or something.
Oh yeah.
Where they're all like, yeah. We're solving all of the world's problems today.
See, this is what, this is what the whole event was about. It's like people coming together, collaborating and solving the climate crisis. We've done it. So
this is why, this is why we needed Caroline back, because in our last episode, I don't think we managed to solve all the problems.
Well, if you had Ryan on, you probably caused a few.
Barely safe to say. So we've got Caroline to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
Like I say, the possibilities on all this, really, when you start to think about it, are endless. But
they are endless. Yeah.
But my time to discuss it is not, so I'll end it there. But yeah, there you go. That's what I learned from COP.
Jobs, though, because I think you said in your piece, Caroline, that this could create local job opportunities. You know, if this vision of patchwork helped.
Yeah, they didn't go into too much detail exactly about how that would happen. I guess data centers themselves actually require very few, relatively few people, but you do wonder like I say, this idea that if you've got an empty retail space at the moment, that if you co-located it with a data center, and that means like, oh, the amount of, you know, we can actually reduce the amount we charge people to hire to rent the space out, the rest of the space out, because we know we've got revenue covered by leasing this data center, that might make some retail spots a bit more viable economically. Already part of the rent is covered by a data center, so it might be kind of jobs like that, I was thinking.
Well, if such jobs were to emerge, then we're going to need people with skills, digital skills. So over to you, Claire.
Thanks, Brian. So one of the things that happened a few weeks ago, around the same time as the beginning of COP, I think, was the autumn budget, where, you know, the government comes together and announces all of its spending plans for various parts of the country and how all of the spending and saving is going to solve all of the UK's problems. And
yeah, I'm sure it was the same sort of time. And it was the same time as Halloween as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, just after Halloween. Yeah. Oh, no, actually, I wrote it just after Halloween.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, because rather than focus on just some of the announcements, I tried to do a little bit of a deeper dive into how people in the tech industry actually felt about some of the things that were reported on. And since skills is something that is, you know, not only that I'm paid to write about, but close to my heart, I focused on some of the skills promises of the budget and how people in the tech sector felt about them. So there were quite a few figures sort of thrown around in the budget in relation to skills, about 5 billion of which was to focus on helping schools and colleges reverse the effect of the pandemic on education. So obviously there were some negative implications to having children learning at home during lockdown. Even though technology sort of saved the day, made sure that everybody could still carry on with education, there are differences between being in a classroom environment with your peers, with your teachers, and being at home digitally interacting. Lots of, you know, like lots of different things, like people feeling like either the school day never ended or that the school day never really began. So it's sort of, you know, like it will change between, you know, like child to child, and some people can't learn that way, and other people thrive in that kind of environment. So yeah, there's been a big focus from the government about investing in education to make sure that any deficits that were brought about by the pandemic are sort of like addressed and reversed, I guess, you know. And as well as that funding, there was around 3.8 billion announced to develop skills across the UK, both for school age children and people already in the workplace. So in some cases that would help people who suffer from a digital skills gap, who might not have, you know, like some of the basic digital skills for day-to-day life, but also people who are in the workplace who, when digital adoption takes place, sort of feel like they don't really have the skills to go forward with a role when things are increasingly becoming digital and it becomes, you know, like part of every industry, every workplace,
yeah,
every part of life. Because the government recently has been really focused on this sort of like lifelong skills guarantee, where people should always feel like they're able to gain the new skills that they need as a result of an increasingly digital economy. So despite all of the stuff that's been announced, both in and outside of the budget, I think basically, as you can imagine, the consensus from the tech industry was like, this is great, more needs to be done. Because, you know, you can throw money at anything, but if there's not a proper structure and proper planning and collaboration in place across industry, government, and education providers, then you end up with the same problems or even different problems, you know, like arising from the fact that some people weren't catered to, or initiatives aren't fit for purpose. Yeah, so as you would expect, it's like, yeah, it's great that these things are being talked about. Yes, the investment's brilliant. We need to be cautious that the issues at hand are actually being addressed.
Have you come across this great resignation idea, Claire? Mm-hmm. That's I think it's an American thing mainly, but it does seem to have a bit of resonance in the UK as well.
I think we've all thought about it.
And in fact, our freelancer, regular Kath Everett, she wrote a piece not that long ago. It was titled, "Is the Tech Sector Facing an IT Skills Exodus?" And she sort of does, you know, like a deep dive into how many tech professionals are actually saying that they're looking to move jobs over, you know, like the next year or so, and why they're looking to move jobs. And then also what that means for skills in the tech sector, because obviously a theme throughout, you know, every time I speak about skills, pretty much, is that there is a technology skills gap in the UK, and either people don't have the technical skills to apply for roles, or the technology talent pool that people are fishing from is very narrow. So,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So you need more people with technical skills, or organizations with the willingness to retrain people and teach them the skills that they need for new roles, in order to make sure that there are enough talented workers to take on, you know, like technology roles, especially since technology is becoming a part of roles even outside of the tech industry as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, if we link to Kath's piece in the podcast article, I think that goes, you know, like pretty far towards answering some of these questions. But you know, I think it's definitely an issue, you know, in the UK as well as in the US, that, you know, like people are thinking of either moving job or leaving the tech sector, which obviously just, you know, it just poses another problem for the sector.
Yeah, it's I know it's something that something you touched on in your kind of skills analysis that we're gonna link to from the article. It does come a lot up a bit in my areas in terms of like HR software, and especially in the US, because basically during the pandemic, a lot of people have been rethinking what the hell are they doing with their lives. And that's what's generating some of that. I just don't know whether it's so much of a phenomenon in the UK, because we tend to be tied down to contracts a bit more. I think in the US, people could leave jobs quite quickly, and also people can be fired really quickly. So maybe it's more of a thing there than it is here. Anyway, I'm speculating.
Well, even if it isn't about leaving a job, it might be demanding more flexibility. So for example, if there's another role that would allow more flexibility, because the pandemic has proven that everybody can work from home efficiently and you don't need to be office and there isn't that presenteeism, if you're not getting that from your current organization and you know that there are ones out of there that have actually learned something from the last 2 years, why wouldn't you move if you knew that you could get more benefits but still do the same job that you're good at, especially when tech workers are in demand anyway?
And there was another story you did this week, Claire, about it's a diversity inquiry, House of Commons Science and Technology Committee.
Yeah. So the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee launched an inquiry into diversity in UK science, technology, engineering and maths, so STEM, basically. With things like this, it's... you know, like the dial doesn't really move. So there's lots and lots of initiatives that are aimed at increasing diversity and inclusion in these sectors, but then nothing really happens. So I think that part of the inquiry is to look into what's currently being done, how much that's actually changing things, and then how industry, education providers, government policy can then move towards making a difference. So it's currently looking for evidence, so it's like in the collecting evidence stage of the inquiry, where you can sort of like submit things about, you know, like what you've seen or what initiatives you know, like are going on within your organization, or you know, like locally or whatever, just to sort of like have a little look at what's already taking place. Because STEM, it seems, it's just one of those areas where, unless you're like, I might be just talking out of the place where the sun doesn't shine on this, but it seems that in sciences, it's the best place to talk out of. But in sciences like biology, for example, gender diversity is better.
Yeah.
But in sort of other areas, it isn't.
Absolutely, you know? Isn't no. How was it with you, Caroline, with your medical biochemistry degree? Was that quite gender diverse, or
it was more women than men? But then I think that's because a lot of the people in that were, it was like a funnel, if you like, to go into medicine as a career. So if you didn't quite get the A levels, you would go do biochemistry degree and then go into medicine or some other kind of sort of medical related field. So I think on the whole, it tended to be swayed more towards women.
Yeah, well, you definitely need more doctors, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the country needs more people with more digital skills. Thank you. Thanks for that, Claire. Tell you what the country also needs, though, and requires, is more justice. It's very hard for ordinary people, you know, without big financial resources to get justice. And yes, I am about to talk about the post office story. The story of the postmasters who were the victims of a massive miscarriage of justice, and we've spoken about on this podcast. So this week, guys, on Monday 22nd, to be precise, a few of us in the Computer Weekly team went to a book launch at the Law Society in London. In fact, it was this book, holding up the book for my fellow podcasters.
That's a very good thing to do on a podcast, hold up a book.
Yeah, I know. And you read it, okay.
The Great Post Office Scandal, the fight to expose a multi-million, move your finger, pound IT disaster which put innocent people in jail, by Nick Wallace.
You know, that's a really good summary of the story, that. I mean, it does sum it up. You know, that subtitle that Claire's just very kindly read out. And it's by Nick Wallace. She said, who's a freelance journalist who's done a lot of work with the BBC in general, I think, but on this story since around 2010, I think. In 2009 Computer Weekly devoted, as will be quite well known, a special issue of the magazine to the story, which, just to remind you quickly, is about how an accounting system called Horizon, installed by ICL, which became Fujitsu, was acquired by Fujitsu, had flaws in it, and how these flaws generated apparent shortfalls in a lot of the takings in post offices up and down the country, resulting in over 700 prosecutions. Our colleague Carl Flinders has written heaps about this story over the years. It's mainly been about Carl. And it was Carl who very kindly got me on the list to go along to the event at the Law Society on Monday. And our editor-in-chief, Brian Gluck, he was there too. It was a good event. It's quite emotional, as you would expect. Some of the postmasters were there. It's very nice to see Carl with them. There's a lot of love for Carl in that community. It's very evident when you see him, you know, with the postmasters and the lawyers and the other journalists who've been involved in covering the story and stuff.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, it would be because it was such a long running issue, it wouldn't be abnormal for someone to just sort of like get bored of covering it if, you know, like things don't move for a really long time.
Yeah, he's really stuck with it and people appreciate that. They really do appreciate it. Also there was Rebecca Thompson. She was a Computer Weekly reporter who, you know, first wrote the series of stories that we published in that special issue back in 2009. And Rebecca had been working on it from 2008, really, until we published. Nick Wallace at the event brought her out to the front, which I think she found rather embarrassing. But it was really nice to see her. I've not seen her for quite some time. Now, in the book, Rebecca's quoted by Nick as saying something that I'd forgotten, I must admit, or half forgotten maybe. And with your indulgence, colleagues, I'll read out this bit. So this is Nick's narrative. He said, "I asked Rebecca what it was like when, after 12 months of solid work, she got to press the button and publish the story. Rebecca said, it was obviously exciting. We'd spent a lot of time getting this right and had really been working up to getting this onto the Today programme or having one of the Sunday papers pick up in it. We genuinely thought it was a great story, but we put it out there and nothing happened." And that's true. You know, we did put it out there and nothing did happen. And the people closest to the story, so that would be Rebecca, but also, you know, Tony Collins, who was our star investigative reporter then. His official job title was executive editor. And our news editor, Bill Goodman. You know, they were all gearing up to be on the Today programme, be on Newsnight, be in the Nationals, and just nothing happened. Interesting thing, though, here, I think, at the event, so Lord Arbuthnot, James is his first name, he spoke, and he's one of the politicians taking a very keen interest in this story all the way through. He's been really critical to the development of it and the kind of fight for justice by the postmasters and so on. But he said at the event that the postmasters had been roundly failed by the political system, failed by the legal system, and by the media. But he did say something about Computer Weekly. He said, "When I was told Computer Weekly had written about it, I knew it was serious." Which is a really nice thing for him to say. Mm. That was a good thing for him to say. And he mentioned Tony Collins, and yeah, I mean, he was generous in what he said there. Now, the book itself is a whopper. But don't be put off, listeners. It's got very short chapters. It's got a great timeline, who's who and glossary. It's a bit of a Bible of the story. And 10% of the sales go to a new charity that Nick and his publishers have set up. It's a foundation to do that. And that'll help the postmasters with things like legal costs, travel costs, but also things like counselling. Some of them have been diagnosed with PTSD. Yeah, because it's pretty harrowing. I mean, imagine, you know, you against the state. That effectively was the situation for them. Well, look, I really wanted to, on this podcast, urge listeners to watch a documentary about the case. It's very accessible. It's on YouTube. It's not long. It's about 30 minutes. It's called Two Decades to Fight for Justice. It's been done by Hudjo Solicitors. They're the solicitors who've represented 39 of the postmasters who've had their convictions quashed, that is to say. It's called Two Decades to Fight for Justice, and I'll include a link to that, or we'll include a link to that in the article. It's very moving. It features our Carl as well, and he's very good on it. I mean, that's a detail, but he is very good on it. And in the article, we'll include a link to the podcast where, remember, we discussed the case earlier this year. That was 23rd of February was when that podcast was published, if listeners want to go and look for it. Anyway, that was then. Since then, some of the convictions have been quashed. And seven more of the sub-postmasters were cleared this week, which takes the total of people wrongfully convicted, just, you know, from Carl's story, to 72. And there's more to come. But Carl certainly will keep writing on this. He isn't going to be giving up. So we'll include a link to that specific story by Carl and to all the stories that we mentioned in the episode, Caroline's and COP 26, Claire on skills. But you both, you know, we all remember that podcast that we did with Carl. It was quite a hard one for us to manage in a way, because it entailed doing an awful lot of reading and coordinating of questions and stuff, but it was really worthwhile doing.
Was I there?
Yeah, you were there.
Cool. Yeah, I definitely read loads.
You did. You did. And you asked quite a few of the questions about the people side of it.
Yeah, that's what I like though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you can I'll include a link, as I said, to that and to the other stories, and you can read that in the article that goes with the podcast on computerweekly.com. But you can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. Well, sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this time round. So it just remains for me to say, as ever, thank you very much indeed to Caroline, and welcome back. Thank you.
That's all right. Glad to be back.
And thank you so much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us, getting all the way to the end. Okay. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.